Yes, sir. Gentleman at the microphone.
Mr. Lockhart, can I be heard? Okay. I just want to preface my question by saying this is purely my perception, and I may be entirely wrong. But reading Sorkin's book and Paulson's writing and so forth, I got the impression that we came pretty close to a catastrophe in September and October of 2008. And if the Fed and the other central bankers had not intervened, we might be in a really terrible situation today. Could you comment on my perception, at least?
Well, I agree with that view. The question was, in reading former Secretary Paulson's book, he came away with the impression that in the fall of 2008, September, October 2008, we were close to a financial catastrophe, and that had the central banks of the world not intervened, we might have really faced a much more severe situation. And as I said, I agree with that view. The circumstances in that period were on the precipice of truly a potential meltdown. Chairman Ben Bernanke of the Fed just yesterday or the day before, just very recently, recounted to some extent that history, and in his view, and certainly mine and others who were a part of it, we were very close to really unknown territory that we had not experienced before. And so decisions were made to some degree in what you might call a battlefield situation with short time decision periods and under great stress to do some things that have become controversial as we look at them in hindsight, but nonetheless have served to stabilize the world's economy and stabilize the American economy and the financial markets. So individually, they may be controversial, but on balance, I think the intervention is actually were very successful.
Yes, over here.
I'd like to ask you the question I almost had an opportunity to ask you earlier today, and that is really whether you have any sense that a repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act would avoid the sort of problem that we had between a Merrill Lynch, Bank of America issue. Thank you.
The question relates to repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, which has been out there as an idea, and in some respects has been supported by former Chairman Paul Volcker, not actually literally, but close, some similar ideas. And the Glass-Steagall Act, for those of you who I understand don't have necessarily a reason to understand this financial history, was the law that was in place until some years ago that separated effectively investment banking, securities issuance, and securities trading from commercial banking. I was a commercial banker for most of my career. The idea is out there. My personal view is that the genie is out of the bottle and it'll be difficult to put it back in the bottle, that the roles played between lending and securities issuance of debt, for example, are intertwined enough that it will be difficult to divide that in some of our largest financial institutions. I am sympathetic with some of Paul Volcker's views about reducing the amount of proprietary trading, which is sort of central to this question, that the large financial institutions do. But again, it's difficult in some respects to distinguish between what is proprietary trading for your own account and market making or support of a client's securities. So there are a lot of technical questions that would have to be clarified. But on the question of Glass-Steagall, I understand the reasons for that view. I simply think it's going to be difficult to actually accomplish it.
Let's swing over here now, sir. Yeah.
Good afternoon.
Yes.
I hope this isn't too simple a question, but what the heck does it really mean when the Fed says they're printing money? Does it go into a wheelbarrow? Did any of it get to my house? How do you do printing money, and where does it come from, and where does it go?
Well, thank you. That, the question is, what the heck do we really mean when we use the term printing money? And I don't like the term. I don't use it much because it's sort of the kind of language that gives an image that isn't totally accurate about what's going on. But here's one way to think of it. The central bank of any country is the only institution in society that can draw a check on itself and the check will clear. Which is another way of saying central banks have the ability to poof, create money and credit someone's account. We also have the ability to drain that money from the system. And that's really what monetary policy is creating and putting in and draining and taking out and trying to calibrate, not technically any longer the money supply, but calibrate through interest rates the supply and demand of money out there. That's essentially what we do. How do we do it? Well, it's, believe me, it's not printing, although we're responsible for the distribution of cash currency. It is essentially an accounting entry and it can be done in a number of different reserve banks under certain circumstances, but most of it is done at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York.
Yes, sir, over here.
One of the uncertainties that you didn't touch on, if it is an uncertainty, is the huge amount of U.S. Securities held by China, something like $2 trillion. And there's always the fear that some of those funds might come onto the market and depress the U.S. dollar further and push up interest rates and have a lot of unsettling effects. The Central Bank of China does not separate their asset into treasuries or other specific assets, as I understand it. And I question whether all of those funds are still hid in U.S. dollars or whether China has been buying up assets all over the world, capital assets of mines and agriculture, things like that all over the world. Mm-hmm. Is that a possibility, and are we perhaps overemphasizing that potential threat?
As of now, I would say it's not an unimportant concern, but you are slightly overemphasizing it as of now. It's a longer-term concern. And the question relates to the People's Bank of China purchasing of dollar assets. They have been a major investor in U.S. treasuries and in earlier years also in mortgage-backed securities that were backed by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and other government-sponsored enterprises. And let me just walk you through quickly how this mechanism actually works. Their exporters sending stuff to Walmart invoice in U.S. dollars because they can't invoice yet in their own currency or they don't want to. So they invoice in U.S. dollars, and they get paid in U.S. dollars, and they earn for their exports U.S. dollars. At that point, they own a dollar balance in a bank account. That bank account is in all likelihood domiciled right here in the United States. No money has left our system in a kind of physical sense, but they become the owners of a dollar balance. They have to invest that dollar balance. So they find some way to invest it. If they had a very, very small balance owned by the People's Bank of China, ultimately, they could invest it in any number of different things. But when you have a very, very large balance, your options get narrower. And so they have become a major investor in U.S. treasuries. And as long as we consume their stuff and they earn our currency, I think they're likely to be very sensible about diversifying away from, or at least dramatically away from the U.S. currency. They are diversifying a little bit, I understand, from reading. I read some of the same articles you do, by buying some assets in other currencies, and also they've formed a sovereign wealth fund. One of my former students actually went to work, Chinese woman, went to work for them. And so they will invest in some other things, but they're their holdings of U.S. dollars are so large that I think we should assume that their sensible policy will continue to be to buy U.S. treasuries and similar securities.
Yes, sir.
You mentioned the percentage of GDP that has been the national debt or deficit and how it's grown. When it was 3%, nobody really worried too much about it. Now, modestly, it's modest conservative projections are 10%, and it'll probably be more. The United States federal government is on the verge of enacting the largest single entitlement program in the history of the Republic. And anyone with any, I think, economic common sense can see that in no way will that bring down the deficit. Do you think that the government has the intestinal fortitude to enact the draconian tax increases they're going to need if we're going to keep that deficit from going beyond 10%?
For someone in my position, there are about half a dozen dangerous references in that in that question. I'm going to dodge most of that question. Let me just frame the situation as I see it, my personal view. I emphasized that early in the talk. First, yes, there was the health care bill was passed yesterday. The Congressional Budget Office has scored it. The Congressional Budget Office is independent. I can say I have personally a great deal of respect for them. They are as good as their assumptions and the information that they're fed. They see the government outlays growing over a 10-year period related to the bill, but they also see it as deficit reducing. I don't know. And I don't know because I haven't really studied it carefully. I don't have all their information, but I just don't know. Is this a follow-up question to that?
All right.
Please, no follow-up question.
No. You have to have a microphone. I'm sorry. Herbert?
It's been very impressive to see how the stimulus plan and the actions of the Federal Reserve got us out of the problems of a year ago. But given the enormity of what has been done and the enormity of resources that were used to do this, what do we have left if there's another crisis? And doesn't that really put pressure on us to get the show on the road right now, fiscally and monetary-wise, to bring things under control?
Well, let me thank you for that question, because it basically touches a theme that I touched on in a recent speech and also in talking to various senators recently touched on, and that is that regulatory reform, as we are now about to go in on the Senate side of Congress to consider what should be done, should be thought about, in my view, as defenses against the next crisis. And they're considering a number of very important measures that would first deal with systemically critical institutions, very large financial institutions, with the goal of trying to reduce or eliminate the too-big-to-fail problem. They're considering what's called resolution authority, something that the regulators did not fully have in the last crisis, an ability, in effect, to designate a risky institution and, in our jargon, resolve it, which means, in effect, to bankrupt it or put it through a process of downsizing or sale to another institution. They are considering how we organize around macroprudential regulation, systemic risk regulation, and the proposal is to create a systemic risk council on which the Fed would participate. All of this, in my opinion, is movement in the right direction. We have to deal with this in order to avoid what are broadly perceived as bailouts, the use of taxpayer monies to save private institutions. We have to do that, and regulatory reform is one way we're going to increase or improve the defenses against the next crisis. Apart from that, we have monetary policy tools similar to what we had in the fall of 2007 and 2008. Fall of 2008, September, October 2008. And at that time, I talked about this at lunch with the board a little bit. The Federal Reserve printed money, created money, and formed particular programs to address problems in specific capital markets. We call these credit easing programs. All of those have expired, and at the end of this month, the biggest one of all, the purchase of mortgage-backed securities, will come to an end as well. So what happened is that we expanded the size of the central bank's balance sheet as an emergency measure. And as we, at some stage in the future, at an appropriate time, decide it's time to begin to tighten monetary policy, we'll remove that. And we have the tools available. I'm quite confident that we'll be able to remove that and shrink the size of the balance sheet of the central bank. If another crisis were to develop, we would have the ability to do that or something very similar, which would be to create liquidity that you use to address individual markets or the broad economy. And no doubt that would be at least in the tool bag of things we would use to address a new crisis.
Yes, sir, over here. I've read a couple of times that Moody's and Standard & Poor's and the agencies have warned the U.S. government that soon, on the track we're on now, soon we will lose our AAA rating. I have no confidence that the President or the Congress are paying attention to that. Can we count on the Federal Reserve to help us prevent that disastrous happening?
Well, the question relates to the rating agencies. Moody's, Standard & Poor's, Fitch are the three major rating agencies in this country. And I think it was Moody's this last few days came out with a commentary, as I understood, a commentary on the permanence of the AAA rating for U.S. government-issued securities, and simply said that rising debt would require require thinking about that rating. And I think that, although there's nothing imminent, it is a good cautionary message out there that, as I said in my remarks, it's important that we move toward fiscal sustainability. The first step is a plan, just simply a credible plan that tells us how we're going to get there. I'm not going to touch the question of tax increases or whatever. We're responsible for monetary policy. Other people are responsible for fiscal policy. But we have a direct interest in how the economy performs, and clearly the monetary authority people cannot ignore the importance of fiscal balance and restoration of fiscal balance.
Yeah, Bert.
You may have already answered my question. My question is that it is a lot of people believe that there was inadequate regulation of the banks and of the bond rating agencies that contributed towards our problem. First of all, do you agree with that? And if you do, do you see evidence to indicate that that problem is going to be properly addressed?
Yes, I agree that the regulatory system didn't match the circumstances and needs to be upgraded. We in the Federal Reserve have already undertaken quite a number of things across the whole system to try to improve our effectiveness as regulators. Among those, in anticipation of what I was talking about earlier, the systemic risk role that I expect will play in Senator Dodd's bill, the Federal Reserve would be responsible for the 50 largest institutions. We've already begun to develop techniques, for example, to do horizontal reviews of risk concentrations One of the problems that I think came clear coming out or during the financial crisis was that bank regulators had focused on individual institutions but didn't fully understand the connectedness between institutions. And we live in a world in which one institution may be viewed as in itself rather safe, but when you take all of the exposures and put them together and you think of a sort of domino effect that could occur, then you recognize that the system may be at risk even if an individual institution looks to be in a safe and sound condition. So we've already begun the process of organizing for and developing techniques to be able to do those horizontal looks across the system to determine where the risks reside. That's just one example. We have been strengthening in a number of different ways our ability to regulate and supervise at all different levels.
Forgive me, I don't care about the details. Do you believe that the government is apparently properly addressing the problem that caused the problem in the past?
Yes.
Thank you.
All right, over here, sir.
Mr. Lockhart, would you help us understand why the so-called subprime mortgages, were a small fraction of the total mortgages, actually directly contributed and brought us close to Armageddon, as you talk about it? And can it happen again?
Yeah, the question is, why did the very small area of subprime mortgage-backed securities trigger such a large financial problem and contribute so greatly to that? And in broad brush terms, there was a fair amount of exposure on the part of large financial institutions in this country and around the world to this category. When they became questionable, then banks began to question really what was on the balance sheet, not only in residential subprime mortgages, but also broadly in other forms of securities that could come under pressure, began to question the strength of the balance sheets of their counterparties, the other banks in the banking system. And in simple terms, they basically said, better safe than sorry, and started to withdraw or reduce exposure to counterparties that they didn't fully understand. So, in effect, this small area raised doubts, and the doubts became more general, and they began to withdraw support. When you do that, and then when they did that, the whole interbank system, what I like to call the plumbing of commercial society, just froze up. And the Fed, as a central bank, was forced to intervene and, in effect, play that role, play the role of providing counterparty support and liquidity, and we did that for a period of time. But now the interbank market has really largely returned to normal and is really operating the way it should operate. So that's one of the reasons we're removing all of these programs that we put in place.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. My concern is this. We stated that Greece has a deficit of over 12% and in financial crises. Gentleman stated we at one time were about 3.7%. We're now over 10%. Now, my concern is, we're so close to 12%. I think we need to back down from that. And could you clarify for us maybe some steps? You've talked about tools and regulation and plans. But what steps that maybe we should look for that we could maybe index our way back down to, say, around 5% or below so that we could have some comfort in that? Thank you, sir.
Mm-hmm. Well, the question, it referred to the ratio of deficit to GDP, gross domestic product. As I cited in my prepared remarks, we've moved from a little over 3% to about 10%, and I think I said that Greece's deficit is at 12%. By the way the European Monetary Union works is they I believe they set a limit of 3%. So 3% is viewed as a standard, and it's a reasonable international standard for being in a healthy deficit position if you have to be in deficit. So the question is, how could we begin to work down from where we are today? Well, reduce the deficit is the first step. Grow the economy so that the deficit in relation to the economy is lower is the second major thing. And obviously the solution is going to be some combination of those two in all likelihood. And the growth of the economy is something that the Federal Reserve obviously has some responsibility for through monetary policy. Also, government policies in general contribute to the growth of the economy. To make this a little bit anecdotal, one of the things we do in the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta is we go all over the Southeast and we talk to people who are in various businesses. We have a number of directors and they talk to people, and we collect anecdotal feedback in advance of my going to the FOMC meetings in Washington about how the economy really feels, what's really going on out there, and what's motivating certain kinds of decisions. We have gotten quite a bit of feedback that businesses of all size, from small to large size, are holding back investment spending, for example, because of a variety of uncertainties that have been sort of looming. Among those uncertainties, for better or worse, is the health care bill. So at least we will get some clarification in the coming days about that, because businesses are interested in how much is it going to cost them, or what's the effect on that individual business. So one anecdotal important aspect of being able to grow the economy is for government in general to try to be clear and reduce uncertainties so that people in the private sector can make decisions. They can plan and make decisions. And so that's something other than simply fiscal policy. It's simply trying to be clear about the direction of regulation and so forth.
Over here.
I've read that we believe that China's currency is undervalued. How do you determine that a currency is undervalued, and why have they elected not to make their currency convertible?
The question relates to the Chinese currency, which is sometimes called the yuan, Y-U-A-N, sometimes the renminbi, which I believe means people's currency or people's money. And it is viewed by some people as undervalued. And so the question is, how do you determine the value of a currency? And secondly, why are they resisting making it convertible? Well, I certainly am not going to speak for the Chinese government, so I'll just give you sort of a former professor's view of this. Well, the value of a currency is hard to determine. It is, in this particular case, what experts believe would be the trading value in a free market, which is a market of supply and demand. And although it is argued, it's controversial, obviously, to some extent, the view here in the United States, widely held view, is that it would drift up, meaning become more valuable and essentially make the renminbi more expensive for U.S. imports. And that might be an incentive to consume less, and it might also, in some respects, be an incentive for the Chinese to do more about their own domestic demand. So those two things kind of go together. Convertibility means the ability to exchange your currency absolutely freely, total convertibility, with no regulations at any time, in any amount, for another currency. The dollar is fully convertible. Other currencies are not fully convertible because usually at the developmental stage of that economy, the feeling on the part of the authorities is they would rather have some control over the inflow and outflow of foreign currency. So they limit convertibility. One of the reasons the U.S. dollar is the world's reserve currency, about 65%, is because of its convertibility. Because anyone who owns a dollar knows that they can sell it immediately for another currency and, in effect, get into whatever currency they want. So, as of now, the Chinese policy is to limit convertibility.
I've read several times that one of the next crises, if you will, is going to be in the commercial real estate area. How bad is it? Is it going to be as bad as the residential crisis was? And if it is, when will this happen?
The easy answer to that is, if I knew the answers to all those questions, I'd own a big house in Naples, which I don't. So let me just say that I am concerned about commercial real estate and the exposure, particularly of small and regional banks, to commercial real estate. We have a capability in the Atlanta Bank of tracking this. It's our view that much of the stress from commercial real estate exposure to the banking system is ahead of us, so that we're sort of entering into a period in which this will play out. I would not go so far as to call it a crisis. I would just say that it is a problem that is going to play out over the next probably 3 to 4 years. In earlier speeches, I've pointed out a circle of linked important factors in the economy. As I said, commercial real estate exposure is dominated by small and regional banks. Small and regional banks are an important, if not the most important, source of credit to small business. Small business is typically, coming out of a recession, the source of job creation. And jobs, particularly knowledge worker jobs, dictate occupancy in commercial real estate or have a big influence on that. So you end up with a circle that can kind of feed on itself. So let me just say we're watching it. It's a serious concern.
All right, this will have to be the last question over here.
Yes, ma'am.
Shouldn't our regulators be better trained and probably better paid so that you can keep them on the job and they don't go to Goldman Sachs or other places?
Well, the question is, shouldn't our regulators be better trained and probably better paid so they don't leave and go to Goldman Sachs or wherever? I can tell you that many of the people who work for me would certainly agree with part of that proposition. But let me say this, because this is something that surprised me. I came to my position from the private sector, and coming into the Fed, I expected that this would be the kind of institution that trained young people, and then the young people left early on. You know, a lot of the large banks sort of play that role. It's where young people go to get some skills, and then they leverage those skills and that experience to get a bigger salary and go somewhere else. To my great surprise, we have a cadre of really long service personnel who have been in the field of regulation and supervision for many, many years. It's not at all unusual to see someone who has 20, 25, even 30 years of experience in the business of supervision and regulation. They are very, very dedicated people, and they are specialists in the field of supervision and regulation, particularly examining the conditions of a bank. And I think, yes, we can always be better trained, and we're undertaking training, particularly in certain areas such as what I mentioned earlier, and that is you know, learning how to identify risk across, horizontally across the system. And we're undertaking a lot of training. But the misconception is that these are all 25-year-olds who are going to be gone in a couple of years. It's really not the case. Very experienced people throughout the system. And I take a lot of comfort in that. We made mistakes, but these are people who are dedicated to their profession and have very high personal standards of performance and are going to, you know, be effective in the future, in my opinion. Thank you very much.